Over 500 years ago, European governments adopted something called the Doctrine of Discovery. With this law's passage, any lands and resources not already ruled by European Christian royalty automatically became their property when their subjects traveled to and occupied those lands. This doctrine of discovery is what legitimized the colonization of the Americas and later other lands, and the genocide and enslavement of millions of indigenous peoples. It was also this doctrine that gave the Catholic Church and later other Christian denominations justification for establishing missions all over colonial territories and forcibly converting millions of indigenous people to Christianity. I tell you this history because I want you to understand just how profound my last week has been. I want you to really understand how moving it was for me to be among the 524 clergy who gathered with elders from many tribes at Standing Rock to publicly beg forgiveness for our tradition's roles in the decimation of Native peoples and their cultures. I want you to smell the wood smoke I smelled from the sacred fire the Standing Rock Sioux have kept burning since they established the Aseti Sakowin camp to try and prevent the Dakota Access Pipeline from being routed through their sacred lands, from being laid at all, given the horrible risk such a pipeline would pose to the water supply of tens of millions of people downriver. And I want you to feel the catch that I felt in my throat as Unitarian Universalist Association President Reverend Peter Morales, in sight of about 1,000 teepees and tents, in the presence of tribal elders from many nations, participated in burning a copy of that doctrine of discovery. I want you to feel the dizzy disbelief I felt at the generosity of these peoples whose entire trajectories my ancestors and culture have all but annihilated. I want you to feel my amazement as their grandmothers smudged and blessed me and the 523 other clergy from many faiths who came when only 100 were asked. I want you to feel my amazement as these grandmothers smudged and blessed me when the purpose of my trip had been to give to them. I want you to feel the rage that burned in my stomach as I saw the heaps of personal belongings and sacred objects the police had trashed after they arrested, stripped, numbered on arms with permanent marker, and left overnight in unheated cells the size of dog kennels, several peaceful water protectors. And then I want you to feel that rage quadruple, as I did, when I learned that the pipeline had originally been routed to go north of Bismarck, the larger city to the north of where Standing Rock is, but that it had been rerouted when the city's mainly white citizenry objected, worried about a leak jeopardizing their water supply. The rage of learning that the governor of North Dakota and his closest friends stand to personally profit from the completed pipeline. I want you to feel the tension that I felt in my body as I walked from camp to the front line where a militarized police force had positioned burned out vehicles and officers in SWAT gear to keep peaceful water protesters from even being able to see the destruction the oil company's construction workers were waging as they dug through sacred lands that include burial and battlegrounds as hallowed to the Lakota and Dakota peoples as Gettysburg or the Alamo are to us. I want you to feel the sense of unease I felt, the sense of being under a microscope as a police helicopter and later a small prop plane circled just overhead of us as we clergy confessed and prayed, sang and listened to the stories and urgings of tribal elders. And I want you to feel the great sadness that slowly settled into me. More every hour that I was in that place, so saturated with over a century of loss and theft and violence, the sadness of knowing that my lifestyle and the very foundation of our way of living here and now is contributing to this hunger for oil. I want you to feel the sadness I felt as I learned that the police were using that same helicopter, that same plane, along with sound cannons and huge prison yard lights to deprive the water protectors from getting sleep at night. The sadness that while I got to get back on a plane and fly home to my healthy and supportive family and the new home and job that I love, many of these peaceful and strong and incredibly admirable people would remain at that camp through the winter or go back to lives in which simply going grocery shopping can be impossible because racist cashiers routinely refuse to serve Native Americans. There is so much more of what I saw that I want to be able to share with you, but I want to end today with what I think is the most important part of my experience at Standing Rock. I want you to feel the sense of the sacred that I did every time I met a water protector. Their grounding in prayer, their profound spiritual maturity, their commitment to peace, even after being treated like animals. These things left me greatly humbled and greatly aware of how much maturing I have left to do. Never once did I hear any of them, whether in personal conversation or from a microphone, speak with hatred towards the police who have been injuring them or towards the Americans whose greed for wealth and hunger for oil have forever crippled the natural resources of the continent that they honored for millennia before colonization. No, they spoke of their growing concern of this pipeline and a prophecy that foretells great destruction if a black snake is allowed to travel from the top to the bottom of North America. And they spoke always of a need for all of us to heal together, all of us to repent, all of us to change our ways and live lives in alignment with the goodness and bounty and beauty of this earth that we share, this earth that sustains us. A water protector I met there named Shoshi, which means rose, reminded me of something that I had long forgotten. She reminded me that the word apocalypse literally means the lifting of the veil, or the time when people begin to see what's always been in front of them. We know that relying on oil to power our lives is bad for the earth and as such bad for us. Our culture has just been working really hard for a really long time to ignore that. May my tiny contribution to supporting indigenous self-determination and supporting the water protectors at Standing Rock. May the contributions of each of us in our own ways from our own locations help tip our world into a new age. May the contributions of each of us help tip our world into a new moral revival where people are valued more than profits, where the health of our planet is valued more than lifestyle convenience, and where love of human diversity is valued more than fear. May it be so.
From the timeliest of messages from Kristen, we hear from two voices from the past whose messages are nonetheless more timely now than ever, perhaps. Our first reading is from Frederick Douglass. He writes, "Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are people who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will." He writes, "Find out what people will submit to, and you have found out the exact amount of injustice which will be imposed upon them. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress." Thus ends our first reading. And these words from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking almost 50 years ago. He wrote, "I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay a hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of people normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. America, the most richest and powerful nation in the world, can well lead the way in this revolution of values. There is nothing except a tragic death wish to prevent us from reordering our priorities so that the pursuit of peace will take precedence over the pursuit of war." So ends our morning's readings. The Unitarian Universalist minister David O. Rankin liked to relate a story from his long career in ministry. In 1968, he preached a sermon much like today, just before the election, and he was not thrilled with the choice between either Richard Nixon or Hubert Humphrey at the time. And so instead of making the case, however subtly, since we don't endorse or oppose specific candidates in church, but instead of even doing it subtly, he decided instead that he would make a recommendation to his congregation. He said he hoped everyone would vote for the most intelligent, experienced, and compassionate candidate. So moments later, just after the service in the receiving line, an angry gentleman came up to him loudly and said, "How dare you use the pulpit to support Hubert Humphrey?" So we're not here to endorse any candidates. I don't even speak out on the many ballot propositions because I'm still trying to figure out some of them myself. Though I encourage you to go online, or we have some copies out in the atrium of the UU Justice Ministry of California's recommendation about all the statewide propositions. And indeed, I know probably many of you have already voted by mail, so this is a moot point. So instead, let's talk politics, but not parties, because I think we need a massive reframe of the way we talk about these things anyway in this country. For decades now, all of my life, we have repeatedly heard about values voters, or the moral majority, and the religious right. Apparently you have to have the same letter in the first two words of these, or it doesn't work. And about family values and pro-life voters, and you could name many, many more, on both sides of the aisle and all across whatever spectrum there is. But I think it's time to change the script, because I am a values voter. And the values that I hold dear are taking care of my fellow human beings and ending oppression and making sure that people have healthy food and a safe place to live. My values are supportive of people of all gender expressions and sexual orientations and all races and ethnicities and religious traditions and national origins. I think my values are truly pro-life, that is, not just pro-birth. And I consider myself both moral and to be a part of a majority because I try to live a good life and not harm others as much as possible and do the right things and be a good person. And I believe that the majority, I would hope all of us indeed, are doing these same things, even if we differ sometimes about how best to go about that. And I hope this goes without saying, but I am religious, though not particularly right. And I'm especially tired of the conversation about religion in this country, assuming that religious people span the gamut from fundamentalist Christians to conservative Christians to slightly less conservative Christians. And if we could let the major news networks know that sometime soon, that would be great, because it's always the religious person on there saying something that I don't agree with at all as a religious person. And yeah, I think I'm pro-life, but not in the narrow, nonsensical way I often hear those who claim that title use. I support life. I want to support the flourishing of all human life. I recognize that women have a better understanding of their own bodies and decisions than I do. I oppose the death penalty, again, because I support life. I'm anti-poverty and pro-prison reform, because I'm for life. I'm pro-medicine and pro-science and even pro-socialized medicine because I'm for life. And I'm even, and here's something you probably didn't expect your Unitarian Universalist minister to say, pro-gun. Though I don't personally own any, nor do I want to, I'm not opposed to guns. I've lived in places where guns are important, and not merely as some symbol, not merely for some inflated sense of self-defense. I lived in rural Mississippi and spent time with people who hunt, people for whom guns are a part of their way of life, with people who, moreover, each of them donated hundreds of pounds of meat a year to a local children's home as part of a program called Hunters for the Hungry. So as we talk about donating our own weight in food, there's more than one way to go about that. So I'm pro-gun in that sense, and pro-responsible gun ownership, and pro-sensible gun control, too. Something that we desperately lack right now, that last one. I would imagine that some of you think about these same things, think these very same things about yourself, or some of them at least, and that you cringe at the destructive and divisive policies and platforms you hear from people who are too eager to lift up their moral framework as the right and proper and only one for our country. Which seems to me as a country far too large, far too diverse, far too amazing to be contained by any one system of thinking or seeing or experiencing. So today, we participate with hundreds, even thousands of congregations around the country as part of something called the Moral Declaration Worship Weekend. Following the prophetic calls of those who have come before us, like Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King Jr., Barbara Jordan and Rosa Parks, and those like the Reverend William Barber working today. Barber has called upon people of faith to make a moral declaration that together we lift up and defend the most sacred moral principles of our faith and constitutional values, which he and the organization of which he is a part, called Higher Ground, articulate as this: we are pro-people and anti-war. We propose equality in education, truly, health care for all, fairness for all people in the criminal justice system, and rights truly in the world for all people, and especially people of marginalized identities who so often don't experience those rights. You can read more about this at higherground.org, and I encourage you to. But with these hundreds and thousands of congregations of many traditions across the country, today we lift up these ideals and challenge our elected leaders to make this their agenda. Kristen's trip to North Dakota, the work our members are doing both here and across the country in the election process, the work we do in our local communities, all of this is part of the same work, the work of creating the beloved community. And whomever is elected Tuesday, this work will continue. So friends, I invite you to vote for the most intelligent, experienced, and compassionate candidates on Tuesday, whoever you think they may be. And then, after that, go love the hell out of the world, each of us in our own unique ways, because the world cries out for our efforts, and no election is going to end that.
Please rise and join in singing. We're going to sit at the welcome table.
We're gonna sit at the welcome table.
So as is our tradition, I invite you to join hands with your neighbors. And as we go out into the world, and for many of us into the voting booth, may our witness help lead all of our communities into better days. And so our worship has ended, and our service begins. I invite you to sit down for just a minute, though, as we invite forward Roger Dillahunty for a special benediction.
You heard this music a little bit ago. The choir's going to sing it from the pews. Roger's going to be dancing, and he may invite you to join in moving at some point. Don't be nervous. It's easy.
Thank you.